This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December 8, 2014. This podcast is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE, and is for your own personal use. Any other use of this podcast without the express written consent of your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to take a look at some of the news that came out this week with regard to federal taxes. One of the big things that happened this week was that we got our first movement that we might call serious on the issue of how the Congress is going to deal with the extenders. And most likely, if this lame duck session is going to deal with the extenders before the end of the year, the bill that we just saw started this week will be the bill that will finally do it. This past Wednesday, the House of Representatives passed a bill that contained a limited set of extenders, plus passed a second bill that would set up a new type of tax-deferred savings account to be used for support of disabled individuals. Both bills passed the House overwhelmingly with bipartisan support. What we'll have to see, though, is whether or not the bills actually get traction in the Senate and whether the Senate takes them up before they leave town and basically go out of town for the end of this session, and therefore essentially leave us without a tax bill at the end of the year. At this point in time, we are still awaiting Senate work, but we will take a look at the provisions in these bills simply because if we're going to get it before the end of the year, it seems highly likely that this is the bill we would get, and therefore this is the bill that would have to be dealt with in terms of your tax planning for the year. So don't assume these will become law, but we will take a look at what we've got in the two bills. The first bill is called the Tax Increase Prevention Act of 2014. It's H.R. 5771. The bill is simply a cut-down, short-term, one-year extension of the various provisions that expired at the end of 2013. This is the cut-down version of the bill that came back out in response to the threatened veto of a bill that would have made number of provisions permanent and would have made other changes. That threatened veto caused the Congress to back off, and so Congress has now come up with this limited one-year only option. The bad news about that is we will be back at the same problem, therefore, next year, since this will effectively extend these provisions only for what's effectively 2 weeks during this year when we know they will apply, and then they will cease to apply again. Now, a number of things are extended here, and they're broken down on the law into individual provisions, business provisions, energy tax extenders, and some issues for multi-employer defined benefit pension plans. Only the last category are things that are actually extended into 2015. On the individual provisions, some of the big things that get extended is we are going to extend the above-the-line deduction for the expenses of elementary and secondary school teachers. So that above-the-line deductions for those teachers will be allowed on the 2014 return. Also, the Congress went ahead and extended, or will the House at least has voted to extend, the exclusion from income for qualified personal residence debt discharge. So if you have discharge of qualified personal residence debt before the end of 2014, Congress will allow you to exclude that from income and reduce the basis of the home. That provision was, interestingly enough, the only provision that was extended only for a single year on the 2012 compromise provision. This caused some people, including myself, to believe that Congress might be ready to abandon it, but it looks like it's going to get one more lease on life, at least if this bill becomes law. In addition, other things were involved in here that came into this issue. Big one is going to be we have this deduction for state and local income taxes, or state and local sales taxes in lieu of income taxes. That's actually the biggest cost item in the individual side of the bill, so it should be useful. So if you're in states that don't have a sales tax or your taxpayer has incurred a large sales tax liability during the year, they'll be able to deduct that in lieu of the state income taxes. Also, the contribution of capital gain, real property made for conservation easement purposes has been extended through 2014. And the above-the-line deduction for tuition and education expenses, as well as the right for tax-free distributions from IRAs for charitable purposes. That this time will be a very limited run because, again, we only know about it with less than 2 weeks to go in the year, so any client who goes down that route will have very short time to pull the trigger and make the direct transfer. Again, since this law has not yet become law, you cannot go out and make that transfer yet, but your clients could plan for it. Also, please remember, once a client has taken a distribution, the first distribution out of an IRA is always the required minimum distribution. While the qualified transfer to a charity can be that distribution, if the client's already got cash out, you don't have 60 days to put it back in because you can't roll a required minimum distribution, so they cannot take any cash out. If they want to use this as their RMD, they can't take that cash out and then later hope Congress and then later put it back in and make a transfer. So you have to be aware. Any clients that are thinking of doing this need to be aware they probably should delay the required minimum distributions until we see what the Senate does or, unfortunately, maybe doesn't do with regard to this bill. Business tax provisions were also extended. The research credit, as always, the old faithful, it got extended again, so that's back in there. Other things that are big, a whole bunch, and I mean, there's a whole litany of various business extenders that are in here, some of which are very, very tailored to a specific industry. For instance, we have the specific one that looks at things like the one that gives us a faster write-off for racetracks, for motor sports facilities. Those are there for certain racehorses. We have those rules. But the ones we're probably concerned about here are a few that deal with depreciation. Number one, the big one, the Section 179 $500,000 limitation is restored for tax years beginning in 2014. Also, bonus depreciation is extended through December 31st of 2014 for acquisitions. We also saw the 15-year special rule for 15-year property for qualified leasehold improvements, qualified real property improvements, and qualified retail property improvements. All of those have been extended. The 15-year provisions have been extended through the end of 14. We also had extended the special rule that allows S corporations to adjust basis for charitable contributions of appreciated property. So we also got extended the shortened period for the built-in gains tax for 5 years. That also will go now for one more year if this bill becomes law. In addition, virtually every other one that we had extended before is in this list. You need to be careful. If you have someone you're specifically interested in, you really should take a look at the bill itself to make sure it's in there. But basically, they didn't leave anything of any note off the list. Everything appears to have made it through. Also, there are various energy tax extenders that expired in 13. Also, those are generally extended through 14. So we have a limited amount there. Finally, some special rules that involve multi-employer defined benefit pension plans, the automatic extension of amortization periods under Section 431, and the shortfall funding method and endangered and critical rules under the Pension Protection Act of 2006. Those both were extended through 2015. As I say, the key thing to do is watch what Congress does with it, and then we have to watch developments as we move forward. After passing that bill, the House went back and voted by an even larger margin to create a new tax-deferred savings account, or tax-basically exempt earning account, a 529 Cap A plan. 529 Cap A plans, like 529 plans, there's no deduction for a contribution to them, but you put money in for a qualified beneficiary. In this case, the qualified beneficiary will essentially be an individual who is disabled and who meets criteria, federal criteria for being disabled, whose disability occurred before they were age 26. So basically, age 25 or younger, they became disabled. You can set up this special account for them. The maximum contribution to the account for the person in any particular year can be no more than the annual gift tax exclusion. The contribution will be considered to be a present interest gift for that person. The cash from this can be used to pay qualified disability expenses. Those expenses are anything that basically relate to the individual's blindness or disability, which are made for the benefit of that person. There are various examples cited by the law specifically, which include education, housing, transportation, employment training and support, assistive technology and personal support services, health, prevention and wellness, financial management and administrative services, legal fees, expenses for oversight and monitoring, funeral and burial expenses, and other expenses. They all need to meet the requirements of a state program. These accounts will be like good old 529 education accounts, have to be established by a state, because they're going to tie into the state's own Medicaid and other services, as well as supplemental security income rules. There are some special exclusions here where this asset will not be counted for SSI purposes. At least up to $100,000 of this account will not be counted. However, any distribution from this account for housing expenses must be counted for purposes of income. Up to $2,000 must be counted as income for SSI purposes. This will allow people, though, in theory, by excluding this from the asset count, to allow this person to essentially have this account but still qualify to receive SSI payments because it will not have excessive amount of assets. And these assets, if these assets are used for any purpose other than qualified disability expenses, there will be the any earnings received will be taxed, and there will be a 10% penalty. The taxation will be under the annuity rules. So we'll be treating it as annuity, so you have recovery of basis plus earnings based on the average value in the account. We have various bases in here. There are ways to transfer this account from one person to another. If they are related in the same family, that's a very narrow definition under these rules. That's going to basically be brothers, sisters, stepbrothers, stepsisters. So if you have two brothers, sisters that are both disabled, you can transfer the account between them. But if you don't have two that are of that sort, then you're going to have this issue where basically it's going to be for this beneficiary. And if you try to take it back out, then that's going to be considered disqualifying distribution. At the death of the beneficiary, the state is allowed to do Medicaid recovery against the balance. So if they have been paying for expenses through Medicaid, long-term care, they're going to take their money first. Any remaining money can then go to another beneficiary. That beneficiary will pay tax on the earnings, but will not have to pay the 10% penalty. ABLE accounts, again, watch the law, see if they're structured. Obviously, it's going to take some time for states to establish programs that work for this. I should note as well that a state may not itself choose to establish a program. It can go ahead and contract with another state that's going to run a program. So we would expect that some of the larger states may go ahead and offer their services to other states that don't want to go through the expense of setting one up. So if you have a client who has this issue, the bill here is the Achieving a Better Life Experience, or ABLE Act of 2014. The accounts are called ABLE accounts. It is H.R. 647. And basically, if you have a client that this could be of interest for, you probably want to take a look at ABLE accounts and see whether it might work for the client's benefit. It is simply a way of basically providing additional funds to the disabled person without disqualifying them from state-sponsored benefits. Now, a couple of other things that happened this week, aside from the bills, I'm going to talk to you about a couple little issues here rather quickly. First, a case of, in relation to the OSG Securities litigation case from the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, docket number 1:12-CV-07948. And it's 2014 TNT 232-7 for those of you with tax notes today. This was actually litigation in an audit context for outside auditors for two audit firms. And the question that arose was whether the audit firm failure to question the advice given to the client by an outside tax advisor amounted to reckless conduct by the part of the auditor, because the outside advisor should be considered to be the equivalent of management asserting that this particular company qualified for a tax benefit. What happened in this case was the outside advisor mistakenly made a conclusion about the applicability of Section 956 to the transactions involved by this taxpayer. There was a substantial underpayment of tax. This all becomes part of the litigation. And of course, they're suing the auditors because of general problems with this outfit, OSG Securities. That's why it's OSG Securities litigation. The court determined that, in fact, the auditors should not be held to have failed to basically, as the plaintiff claimed, performed any audit at all on the tax matter, simply because they had relied upon the outside advisor. The auditors had determined the outside advisor had expertise. They had come up with an analysis. The outside auditor did not have to treat that with the same level of skepticism that they treated any documents would have come from inside the company, because as the court pointed out, insiders, the management has an incentive to, you know, kind of doctor things to make them look good. The outside entity facing legal liabilities outside the securities context clearly does not have that incentive, and the accounting firm was not being reckless by putting additional reliance in that document beyond the reliance they would have put in a document had it come from management itself. Now, they're not out of the woods yet, because the court noted there's still going to be a question of whether the auditors did perform sufficient research into this area, but the good news for the auditors is the court held they cannot be charged with fraud in this area, and obviously fraud tends to make your damages much higher. So that was good news for the auditors in this case. We also have an informal claims case, Palomares versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-243. In this case, this woman, who spoke very little English, was in a relationship with what turned out to eventually be an abusive husband. They had a 1996 unpaid tax liability. In 2005, she left him. Now, the catch was she had limited English, and she really didn't have anything to do with filing a tax return, so she was totally unaware of the tax situation of the couple. In 2005, 6, and 7, she worked, and she earned wages, and she had refunds that she should have been paid those years, but those refunds were seized by the IRS and used to pay the back taxes from 96. Now, she didn't understand why that was happening, so she went to a legal clinic. She knew she didn't get the refunds, and she got some letter from the IRS about it. The legal clinic unfortunately informed her that she should file an injured spouse claim. Injured spouse claims only apply to joint returns. She had not filed a joint return for 2005, 2006, and 7. Also, the legal clinic only suggested she file it for 2007, did not have her file that same form for 6 or 5. She got a letter from the IRS shortly after she filed that, indicating that she didn't qualify for basically injured spouse because there was no joint return, but also suggesting maybe she should file the document for innocent spouse. Well, again, her understanding of English was very limited. All she got from the letter that she understood was she wasn't getting the refund. Now, fast forward a couple of years. She gets divorced from this gentleman. Her attorney who handled the divorce did finally take a look at those documents, did see those documents. He figured out the IRS was applying against the 96 taxes, and he told her that she should go ahead and file innocent spouse claims, which she did for 2005, for her refunds from 2005, 2006, and 2007. Unfortunately, by the time she did so, the statute of limitations for claiming refunds on 2005 and 2006 had closed. The IRS therefore said, yes, she was entitled to innocent spouse relief, but only for the year in which she could claim a refund. So she got back her 2007 refund, but she hadn't given up her 2006 and 2005 refund. The taxpayer argued in court that her initial claim for injured spouse should count as an informal claim. The court, unfortunately for her, disagreed. It noted that that injured spouse claim gave no evidence that she was filing for any year aside from 7, also did not make it clear that 1996 was really where the tax liability arose and that there was a question if she was an innocent spouse for 96. The court also said you could not hold the IRS accountable because they helpfully suggested maybe, you know, this looks like you're not an injured spouse, so maybe what you should be looking for is innocent spouse. They said we're not going to penalize the IRS for being helpful. Rather, we're just going to simply say that she waited too late and she simply missed under the statute. The court found that she did not meet the requirements for informal claim, neither on an equitable standpoint or under the standard test, because the form she filed with the IRS simply did not give the government enough information to apprise them of the nature of her claim, regardless of what happened. Finally, we're going to take a look here at the IRS asserting a penalty at tax court. This is a case of Illinois Tool Works versus Commissioner, and this is a tax court order. In this case, the taxpayer's exam had finalized up, and there was an issue they were disputing. The issue was a fairly big one, as I recall. The numbers here were looking at a $70 million adjustment the IRS had proposed. But the IRS had, interestingly enough, not proposed a substantial understatement penalty, though they had discussed substantial understatement penalty with another issue that eventually the IRS gave up on in favor of the client. Now, suddenly, when they go to tax court, the taxpayer files their petition with the tax court. The IRS files their answer, and in the answer, they assert the substantial understatement penalty. The taxpayer claimed foul. Wait, we had solved that on exam. There is no penalty. The tax court said, no, this is not bringing up a matter that they're not allowed to bring up that was somehow covered by the notice of deficiency. Rather, the IRS has the right to bring this up because clearly you would meet the mechanical test for this penalty if it was applied. The service can assert it. The only negative for the service is they will have the burden of proof where previously they might not have. Of course, the interesting part is in this particular penalties, they generally always have the burden of proof for initial levels. In this case, the initial level burden of proof is merely showing that the assessment's over the magic trip limits, and from then you have to show reasonable cause. So while it does not mean the taxpayer has a penalty because we've not yet adjudicated whether the taxpayer owes the tax, it is a reminder that pursuing your remedies moving forward can sometimes result in a worse result for the taxpayer than if they had simply taken the initial assessment and signed off on it. So you do need to be aware when you move forward about the risks in this area. This again, Illinois Toolworks versus Commissioner, case number 10-418-14. This finishes it up for this week of the tax update. Be sure to join us again next week when we'll talk about any developments that occur in that week in taxes.